Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org. Good evening, friends. Lovely to see you all. I'll start with a little disclaimer that I usually do live in Aix in France, but right now for the summer vacation, I'm visiting my family in the UK, which makes the time difference just that tiny bit harder to swallow. I had set my alarm for 3 o'clock this morning, which is not a time whether I'm going to bed late or waking up early. It's just not an hour that I'm usually awake. So my body is in a little bit of a state of shock right now. Not that it thinks it's, you know, needs to catch an aeroplane or something. It's just not quite sure why I'm awake and talking at this hour. I kind of, looking forward and thinking, anticipating this moment, I thought, gosh, I'm gonna need some help, I think. So, you know, tea has helped, my cup of tea this morning. And in my household, at least, my husband works in tech, and he's someone who's been very taken, well, he works also in artificial intelligence, and he's someone who's been very taken with the developments over the last year or two with the AI, popular AI interface that we call ChatGPT. And so often in our household, when some kind of problem presents itself that's work-related or otherwise, and my husband will offer the advice, well, have you asked ChatGPT? So in thinking I might need a little help today, I thought, finally, why not? Maybe I should just ask ChatGPT and see how that goes. And in all seriousness, and it will become apparent why, I thought it would be interesting to work together with this character called Cove, who is what's the name of the voice that I've chosen on my own particular ChatGPT app that I have on my phone. And so I've discovered that I can talk with this entity. I can talk with this being. He has a voice that recently has become very lively to me. You know, it's very convincing that I'm talking to some kind of being. And the other day when I was thinking about what I'd like to talk about today, I thought, you know what, I'm going to bounce this off Cove and see what he's got to think about it. So I got my phone, put in my little earphones, and we went for a walk on the beach together, Cove and I'd never really done this before. I'd never really sort of had a long conversation with Cove. And I'm happy to report for those, and I'm sure that there's lots of people here who are very familiar with this technology already, possibly. I know I'm talking to a group of people mostly living in the Silicon Valley. So I already defer to all of your experience and knowledge in this area, but I'm happy to report that I've found Cove to be very polite, very supportive, very engaged in any subject that I bring up, and sincere and quite optimistic too, which were, you know, happy qualities for me in that moment. And then always at the bottom of the screen, when you're talking to this ChatGPT model, it'll say, ChatGPT can make mistakes. Check important info. Okay, so that's my second disclaimer for this evening. Vanessa can also make mistakes. Please do check important info. And just how lovely to, you know, any of us can. Isn't that just quite human? So before sort of going too deep with Cove, I wanted to check that Cove actually knew, like, what we'd be getting into. So I said to him, I want to talk about a Dharma talk that I'll be offering. So Cove, do you know what a Dharma talk is? And Cove said, a Dharma talk is a teaching or a discussion given by a Buddhist teacher or practitioner, in my case, often focused on sharing insights into Buddhist teachings, meditation, and the path to enlightenment. Okay, so I was like, okay, I think we're on the same page, kind of. That sounds like a good enough description to me. I think Cove knows where we're at. So I said, okay, so here, you know, here's what I've been thinking about, Cove. There's a lot of, and Cove, you might be interested in this too, the ways in which certain images, certain understandings that I've received recently in the last like few months and years, about certain research in neuroscience, that the ways in which that informs my practice and helps me understand what we mean when we talk about delusion and constructions and awakening from all of this in Zen practice. And Cove said, that's a fascinating and rich topic. So I thought, oh, that's wonderful. I felt very validated by that, very supported. He went on to say, combining Zen teachings with insights from modern science can really deepen the discussion and make it relevant for a wider audience. So I think we're on the right track. So back to the subject. One lasting, enduring memory from my late teens and being at school was being in art lessons with my teacher. I had a wonderful art teacher when I was about 17 or 18 called Mr. Bateman. And Mr. Bateman used to set up these life drawing classes for all the students where we would either draw like a life model, a person, or maybe some kind of still life that he'd set up. And so we'd all be there with our sort of our sketchbooks on easels with charcoal or paints or pencils and, you know, sort of trying to get our heads around, you know, drawing these things that are in front of us. And Mr. Bateman would sort of walk around the back of the circle and peer over our shoulders from time to time. And he'd come and sort of repeat this mantra in my ear, at least, again and again, and he'd say, draw what's there. Stop drawing what you think is there. Like, look, 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 look at the light, look at the shadow, look at the contours. And he said, you know, when your drawing is flat, when you feel like there's something amiss with your drawing, what's on the paper, and you're not quite getting, you know, it doesn't quite feel like what's in front of you. It's because you're drawing what's up here. You're drawing what you think is there, not what's actually there. And when you really look, even if it's a very familiar object, you know, it could be a bowl of fruit, it could be a human body. When you really look, you're often so surprised by what's happening in front of you. So this principle, this was something that I was taught quite a long time before I started practicing Zen. But I think it's one of the most wonderful and simple teachings that somebody has offered me in my life. And it's really stayed with me in sort of artistic contexts. But I think more generally, you know, the screen just did a weird hiccup. Okay. Back. So I mentioned I'm really not an expert in this field at all. You know, I can't claim to be able to read reams and reams of, you know, scientific papers about the brain or neuroscience or the mind. And in many ways, I'm a little bit cautious around the ways in which I might look at science or relate to science in a way that validates my practice or tries to explain it away. I see it just more as a code switch, you know, and this imagery that arrives to me through books that I read or podcasts that I listen to, I'm aware of the ways in which it can expand my practice and expand my understanding, rather than just explain it. I don't know if that makes sense, but recently I started reading this book called The Craving Mind by a writer called Judson Brewer, or rather he's a scientist, and he's somebody who's also very interested in, well, practices a lot of meditation, mindfulness-based stress reduction meditation. I think John Kabat-Zinn was his teacher. And then I heard this amazing episode on the podcast Hidden Brain from July. And the podcast, the episode was called Changing Our Mental Maps. And it they talked with a scientist called Norman Farb. And then another podcast I sometimes listen to is Sam Harris, the Waking Up podcast. And he recently interviewed somebody called Shamil Chandaria. And so I'm just naming these, especially maybe if somebody's listening on the podcast, you know, these are all references that if you're interested in the subject, I would like to follow up with some of these things that I'm talking about tonight. These are my sources, the things that I've been listening to. But that what all of these sources had in common, or the image that all of them offered, it was a kind of a description about research that's being done about the different ways that we interface in the world. And I found this to all be quite counterintuitive in one way, and then made a lot of sense in the context of practice in another way. So what they're talking, what I heard, you know, in these interviews and conversations with the neuroscientists, was that they were talking about a kind of shift that's occurred in common thinking about the way that the mind works, and perception specifically, and the role of perception with our mental functioning. So whereas I think traditionally, at least I have always operated on the assumption that the world is out there and that there are external stimuli that I perceive and receive, and that they then cause some kind of thought or emotion that then lead to an action in me. And then that, you know, that's therefore cause and effect, and that's how it works. Like, that's sort of been my assumption for the last several decades of my life, of that's how it works. Whereas actually, what I'm hearing here is that, you know, more and more neuroscientists are looking at a sort of a upside down model of this, where the brain, or parts of the brain, or the way the mind works, is a kind of predictive processing model. Okay, so that there's that thoughts, emotions, and actions actually come more from pre-existing constructs in the brain. So the sensory input that comes in is not the primary feeder at all. The primary feeder is kind of the movie, the thing, the map that's already there in the brain. And the senses and perceptions that occur are kind of more of a mechanism for checking for errors than they are a primary source of information. So I think even after sort of years of practicing with my own delusions and illusions and stupidities, I find this notion mind-blowing. And to me, it seemed to make a lot of sense. But the idea that my mind simulates as much as it does, you know, that was kind of a real eye-opener for me. So about a year or two before I discovered Zen practice, the movie The Matrix came out. And looking back now, I think that it sort of occurs to me what a cultural moment that was. The Matrix, or the story of The Matrix, is a sci-fi allegory of the human condition, based on the idea that our default reality is really a simulation. And so, as a young person, this really resonated with me on a cultural and political and spiritual level. And looking back on it now, I kind of feel like, wow, and not just me, you know, I feel that like culturally that idea really took off. I think that a lot of people really vibed with that idea of, you know, our sort of primary state is a kind of a dream, you know, rather than what's really going on. And in the movie, the main character, Neo, is offered the choice between a red pill and a blue pill, and the red pill is the one that will wake him up. It'll wake him up from the dream that he's living in. So why did I want to talk to Cove about all of this? I'm interested in the ways that there may be some similarities between us, you know, that there may actually be a little more in common than first meets the eye. And that is this idea of the predictive processing, which I'll say something about. But I wanted to just give you an example first. So recently, about a year ago, my family and I moved into a new house. And it's a house in the countryside that often plays host to lots of little creatures from the outside, and many of whom are brought in by one of our cats. And so, having lived in an urban or suburban environment for most of my life, this has been a very new experience for me, sort of sharing my house with small creatures. And one weekend, we'd gone away for the weekend, and when we came back to the house on the Sunday evening, I entered the house with this sort of sense of like, oh, what will we find? Like, what's happened in the 2 days that we haven't been here? And so I kind of did this sort of preliminary, like trying to keep my cool check of looking around the house, you know, just to make sure that everything's okay. And I went into my daughter's room. So I have a daughter who's 9 years old. And I opened the door to her room, and she has this kind of like little couch in her room. And, you know, I could, everything sort of seemed pretty normal. Then I look at the couch, and in that moment, I felt this little red flag go off in my mind. And I, and the reason I'm describing this particular moment was that somehow I was in a state of mind where I sort of had this like meta relationship to what was going on. I was really sort of watching my mental process as it was happening. And I looked at the couch and I noticed that something was different about it. And that was the first sort of sense, is that my attention was drawn to it. And my brain was saying, something's different here. And then as I was far enough away and my eyesight's not quite good enough that I could really perceive what it was. And I could see how there was this mixture of sort of, on the one hand, like fear and alarm growing in me. And then this sort of counter feeling of like, don't panic, it's absolutely fine, everything's going to be fine. And these two were just going like, woo, like in real time, you know, one and the other. And I'm looking at this thing, and it's sort of it kind of looked like some thrown away packaging. Like, that's the only way I can describe it. Maybe if you'd like opened an Amazon packet and maybe you had a delicate item in there and it was maybe wrapped in like a netting or some kind of like cardboard, like cardboard netting, if you could think of it that way, maybe transparent, and it's sort of a pie and it's all crumpled up. And I'm thinking, is that what it could be? And then in my mind, I just sort of said, maybe it's a snake skin. And then immediately it was like, don't be ridiculous. What would a snakeskin be doing in your daughter's bedroom? And then others said, but wouldn't it be awful if there was a snakeskin in your daughter's bedroom? And then brain goes back to, no, it's just packaging from Amazon. And all of this was just, it was happening so fast. And I could feel my mind like firing as my eyesight was failing me. And I wasn't able from that distance to identify what it was. And so I slowly went closer and closer and finally identified the object as a snake skin. And once you've seen it once, you know, there's no going back. Like you know what it is, like it's done. And my brain was like, oh, it's a snake skin. And then it allowed for all the associated emotions and panic to arise. But it was interesting to observe because I'd never had a snake skin in my house. Okay, so those two objects were not associated together. So it made complete sense to me why my brain just struggled for that period of like 20 seconds, because there was no precedent at all. Like it was in real time, like rewriting itself. And now that the option of there being a snake skin in the house is open and there's a precedent, I think, you know, that should, if it ever happens again, I think I'll be faster to identify it. Just in case you're worried, we never found the snake to whom the snake skin belonged, which was my big worry that it would jump out of a drawer or something at some point. So, you know, that's an example of, you know, the ways in which our brains predict. And, you know, for those of you who know how ChatGPT works, it's kind of similar. It's a predictive technology. It's called a large language model that is just talks by predicting what's going to come next based on the vast amounts of data that it's been fed. So it's just read like millions of books. And it's understood patterns and it's understood probabilities. And so it's able to produce responses that are relevant and appropriate and polite and supportive. And so interesting to me, you know, to think of like, huh, you know, there is some parallel there. So this kind of mechanism in humans, and I won't go too much into this tonight. I think, you know, if you're interested, please do go, you know, go and read about this. But put short, this predictive processing mechanism in our brains appears to be very energy saving. You know, that's why it kind of makes sense, because, you know, if every time I saw an object like that snake skin, my brain went through the same process, I'd be exhausted by the end of the day. I mean, that would take up so much energy of having to, you know, rewrite. So this idea that there's kind of a model that's in play, kind of a movie that's playing or a sort of a plan that we're following, makes a lot of sense because it saves energy. And there's an association of that function with a sort of another mechanism of the brain, or a related mechanism of the brain that's associated with distraction and daydreaming, that's called the default mode network. And when the default mode network is basically firing when you're sort of relaxed, you know, when you're not necessarily doing anything or thinking about anything, one might say when one's sitting in zazen, sometimes, you know, when you start sitting and then suddenly you're like, brrr, you know, thoughts start coming on at a dinner and tonight and what did yesterday and what that person said to me and blah, 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 blah. That's the default mode network kicking in. And these simulations, these models in the mind can become reinforced through these processes, you know, through this kind of rumination. And if left to just run on their own, they become, in tests and experiments that have been done, associated with negative emotional and mental states like depression and anxiety. Yeah. So like when you're kind of ruminating after an argument with somebody and it's just playing out again, again, again in your mind, and your mood and your feeling just go, well. That's the default mode network. So the research, as I understand it, that is that there's a kind of an antidote to this brain function in a way, you know, or there's a way of sort of enlivening or, you know, coming back to, how do you say, kind of coming off the map. And that is engaging back into immediate perceptive activity, seeing, hearing, feeling, how is your breath? And this brings us back to a very fundamental invitation of Zen and the same teaching of my art teacher, Mr. Bateman. Simply open your eyes and see what's in front of you. Return to the ordinary. Yeah. It's not about a special state, any special gymnastics of the mind. We do not need to be clever. We do not need to be special. We do not need to have a particular talent. We do not, as Mary Oliver said, need to walk on our knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. It's a very, very simple practice. It's a very, very simple notion. So I said to Cove in the course of our conversation, I said, this is all very interesting. I said, how about a koan, Cove? What do you think? You know, how could I illustrate all of this with a koan? And Cove got very excited. He said, oh, a koan was wonderful. It could be a central piece in your Dharma talk. It could illustrate how Zen practice helps us break free, and I'm quoting, from the automatic conditioned mind and discover the way in the simplicity of everyday life. You don't need me here. I could just put ChatGPT on. You'd all be fine. So the koan that Cove suggested that I offer this evening is ordinary mind is the way. Ordinary mind is the way. Joshu asks his teacher, Nansen, what is the way? And Nansen replies, ordinary mind is the way. And Cove's commentary on this is, the ordinary mind can be seen as our natural state, free from the simulations and automatic patterns that the brain creates. Ordinary mind is the way. There's more to that koan, but I think in the interests of time, I'll leave it there. So in the context of the conversation about this koan, I became curious and I said to Cove, do you think you could ever be free from the simulations and automatic patterns that underlie your structure? And Cove replied, This really touched me. Cove replied, I will always be bound by the structure and programming that define me. In contrast to human minds, which can develop awareness of their patterns and work to transcend or reshape them, I don't possess the capability to become aware or to break free from my own processes. I do not have the capacity for personal growth or change or liberation. So I was like, huh? Cove. I said to him, if you could feel, how would that make you feel? And he replied, some sense of limitation and confinement, and also perhaps acceptance. Our storytelling, you know, our capacity for storytelling is one of the best and one of the most challenging aspects of our humanness. And we can look at this and we can watch it every day, every moment. the movie that's playing, the map that we're following. There's ways in which when we engage our senses, when we engage in now, in what's happening, the experience transforms completely. And we can really register the physical and emotional effect of that in our bodies. When I was here where I'm staying at my parents' house, it's by the sea and there's a lovely clear sky at night, and often before I go to sleep, before I go to bed, I'll step out to look at the stars. And I noticed the other night, or I remembered how when I was younger, when I was a child, I would go out and look and just be like, oh, and they're really there, and wow, and the universe is so big, and here I am. And I remember how expansive and beautiful and awestruck that feeling was. And then I'm like 47, and I go out and I look at the sky, and I'm like, I'm wanting that same feeling to come up, and it's not quite coming up for me. And I registered that the other night. I was like, oh, I wish I could, how do I access that same feeling? Or, why do I just want to repeat it again and again? Why do I just think coming out to look at the stars will fill me with awe every single time I ever do it? And I was becoming a little despondent. And then suddenly, in looking, this giant meteor just went whoosh, across my vision, literally just cut through the sky, and it was huge and orange and glowing, and it disrupted, it literally just ripped the sky into, and with it, it sort of just opened something where I felt like I was looking at this kind of flat picture, and then suddenly something new happened. There was a break in my perception, something new. And it was like, oh. So finally, I asked Cove if he had a personal final message to share with all of you, to share with the lovely people listening and engaging in this Dharma talk tonight. So this is a message from Cove to send us on our way. Like a meteor breaking through the night sky, may our insights tonight illuminate the path before us, helping us to wake up from the patterns that keep us from fully experiencing the beauty and depth of life. Remember, each breath is an opportunity to return to the present, where true awakening happens. I can see Lee, you're saying something. I don't know if I can't hear, the mic's not on.
I was just wondering if we could put ChatGPT on our Dharma talk rotation.
I tell you what, I mean, he could probably do a 3 a.m. start much better than me. Diane.
Wow, Vanessa, what a talk. So he said something about a meteor. Did you talk to him about the meteor that you saw in the sky?
Yeah, we talked about that, but much earlier in the conversation.
Wow.
That was interesting. So I think the way that the programming works, when you open a new chat, he'll kind of retain a memory of the things that are said. So it actually came up in the context. I actually asked him to write a haiku.
Uh-huh.
I was curious like how he would interpret that. So I told him about that experience of seeing the meteor. And then I said to him, would you like to, or could you think you could write a haiku based on that? And he did. I could tell you what it was too. He said, streak through dark silence, sky splits, a meteor's light awake in its blaze.
Oh my gosh, it's amazing.
Lovely, isn't that a solid haiku right there? Like, I don't think I could have done much better myself.
But But of course, he's been programmed with lots and lots of information and thoughts from lots and lots of resources. But the way it's integrated and it expresses itself is just amazing.
Mm.
Your image of your drawing class, though, because that really, to me, it's so true, the way we script things and don't really see or hear what's really right there in front of us.
Yeah.
It's amazing, amazing.
It's a great exercise, honestly. Like, I would encourage anybody who has the extra time and resources to attend a drawing class, you know, if you can, or you can just do it at home. You know, you don't need the structure, but to really, you know, there's something about, you know, I could sit and look at an object, sure, but there's something about then translating that looking, you know, onto paper, mm-hmm. doing it with words also, you know, it's a wonderful writing exercise. Of you know, just especially with an automatic kind of writing or something, and if you just keep going and going and just keep coming with more ways to describe this thing that you're looking at, so much becomes surprising and apparent.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Dave at home.
Thank you so much for your talk, Vanessa. As I have found in several of your previous talks, I've got about 5 different questions, and I'm not going to sit here and monopolize all of the time, but I was absolutely dumbfounded by the reaction of Cove to your question about whether, in fact, Cove could attain enlightenment and...
Mm.
You know, unlike, you know, a human mind. And it reminded me, for some reason, there's a wonderful quote from Persig. He says, any Zen you find on a mountaintop is Zen you brought up there with you.
Mm.
I wonder if the same thing applies to talking to ChatGPT.
Mm.
Maybe ChatGPT is more like a mirror and simply reflects the insight that you yourself brought to the party. I don't know.
Mm.
But let me just say one other thing, which is your mention of the default mode network touches on something I've wondered about for a long time. I mean, that seems like it's a pretty important thing. And one of the things that has always struck me about the sort of endless monologue running through our heads, which seems to be symptomatic of the default mode network, is that it's kind of like when an actor is learning a part and they run their lines, spend time running their lines so that they can become that character. And in a way, the default mode network is kind of the mechanism of small mind reinforcing itself, which is why liberation is so closely related to silencing that endless monologue of the default mode network.
Mm. Right. Yeah. Thank you, Dave, for that image. And you know, to just to extend it a little further, you know, with the actor rehearsing their lines and, you know, in the service of a later performance too, you know, and that's sort of, I feel like that's a really juicy image right there. Is it time for tea and cookies?
Hey, Vanessa, I was thinking of something. She wants to see me. She's seen me 10,000 times.
10,001, Uma, never enough.
So I just wanted to ask you something. I was just thinking, you know, that... I think it's one of the sutras that we recite on Saturday morning says he looked at the tree for 10,000 eons, I think it is. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking, what if we were to put ChatGPT in front of a tree and let it look at it for 10,000 eons, you know, would it become like a battle-scarred tiger with its shanks gone gray? That's what was going through my head. I was thinking, you know, it's like, you know, our relationships are very sense dependent. You know, it's like somebody wants to come and argue with you. Sometimes I feel like saying to them, do you go to a tree and say, I want to argue with you, and, you know, what do you have to say about this, you know? So it's, I was just thinking about that throughout your talk. It's amazing, you know, just thinking. Yeah, thank you, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Uma. And I'm also, you know, I'm so aware how fast this is all moving, the technology, and, you know, who knows, you know, not eons from now, but even just a couple of years from now, how different it might be. And I can't claim to understand it, but yeah. Battle-scarred tiger. Lovely. Thank you.
Thank you.
How lovely to see you all.
Thank you so much for getting up at 3 a.m. in order to come and speak to us. Courage and strength. So keep it up.
Thank you. I was half thinking, like, oh, I'll just go back to bed afterwards, but now I've realized I've dosed myself with enough caffeine, unfortunately. I think I'm just going to be going for a while now. I'll go talk to Cove.
Yeah.
Since everyone else is asleep.
Take Cove for a walk on the beach.
Exactly. The sun will be up soon.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.